Hi everyone, welcome to the summer series of the Quest Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. I wanted to give a special introduction to these four episodes. This has been a busy travel year for me, so this short season 5 was recorded during those travels. I warn you, some of these recordings are on location, on a train, the beach, other outdoor locations, so it's a little rough in a few spots, but I really enjoyed these people and what they had to say in their interviews. All four episodes are available now. Thank you for listening, and look for season 6 coming soon. Life is a quest for logic and reason. It is a quest to find balance between science and faith. Life is a quest for knowledge and understanding. But most importantly, it's a quest for personal discovery. Whatever your quest, knowing yourself is the beginning of all wisdom. Welcome to Quest. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Quest Podcast. With me is a very special guest, an old friend of mine, a guest from the first season of Quest, Paige McCauley. Welcome back to the show, Paige.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back. Do another episode of something different.
It's been a while. And, you know, in a moment, I'm going to explain kind of the catalyst, how this episode came about. It's been a while since the viewers have heard from you. You were actually my third guest in the first season of the podcast way back in 2020. I mean, we were back in COVID when we talked last. And we, you know, we're friends. So we chat every once in a while on social media. And I realized it had been a long time since you've been on. And, you know, I really want people to go back and hear that first interview because it was just so great and so compelling. And just sort of a nutshell, you know, you are a behavioral therapist. And we got into a great discussion about kids and identity issues. And we talked about souls and past lives and got into God and all kinds of stuff. Great interview. Everyone go back to the first season and listen to that because today is much different. Different interview. And
they do align, though, I will say. We kind
they,
of
they will align.
With That's my good. Professional will, field and this journey I've been on.
This will bookend for sure. And this came as a huge surprise to me when I saw this and you posted this on social media. You posted a 6-month coin from AA. And I was shocked. I had no idea. Like, I thought, how could I not know about this, you know? And I reached out to you and I said, I can't believe I'm seeing this. Like, this is crazy. I had no idea. Like, not that I'm in social circles with you or anything, but like, I had no idea you were carrying this dark secret. So tell the listeners about this dark secret that you were carrying.
Well, as we all start in AA, hi, I'm Paige. I'm an alcoholic addict. Wow. My journey has been, it's been a bit different than a lot of other people. I am a child of an alcoholic, so I always kind of knew that I am, and I was playing with a very, you know, dangerous type of fire. I was teetering that line for a very long time. I'm still young, which a lot of people kind of look at that a little differently. I'm only 29 years old, but I spent my college years and after recognizing some things that I just didn't like. I wanted to escape myself in any manner I could possibly do. For me, I grew up in a household that was, you know, you keep quiet, you put a smile on, and if you need to, go get a drink. You know, and that's kind of what I had picked up on. I had picked up on that, you know, if you just walk outside and act like you're okay, you could go out later and let loose, you know, you can get it out a little bit. And when I had moved to Tennessee, I'm not even sure what year that was. I want to say 2019 or 18. You know, it was the first time I had spent 4 years away from my family. I'm very close with my family. And my sister actually went, she just woke up one day and said, I'm done. She knew her patterns. I'm done. And I did the other thing of I wanted to fix, manage, and control. I spent a very long time being like, okay, well, whiskey and bourbon make me fight people. So what if I try vodka and tequila? Tequila makes me friendly. And then tequila turned into arguing with people. So then I was like, okay, maybe I should just stick with wine. Okay, so I'm only going to drink wine. That didn't go over well either. And then I did, okay, well, high noons, you know, those seltzers. Seltzers can't get you too messed up. Wrong. When you're buying multiple cases, they will do the same thing.
Wow.
And it was more of, for me, that I was holding a lot deep down for a really long time. I had some trauma that happened to me as a kid that I never spoke about. I've been in therapy for 6 years, and it even took me a long time to talk to my own therapist about it. When I got drunk, I would talk about it, but not, you know, not in a clear mind sound. So sure. The people I were with, you know, would genuinely care and be like, what's going on? And I'd wake up the next day and be pissed off. You're trying to have this conversation with me. I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to talk about childhood trauma. I don't want to talk about suicide. I don't want to talk about any of that. I have it up here. I'm not going to have this conversation with you. And
right.
When I moved back home, I was actually in, first started with my diagnosis of bipolar. You know, I had a hard time with that too. I didn't want to accept that and tried to fight that. Alcohol also doesn't help with mental illness. For anybody who didn't know that, it does not help. But I had started being in therapy, and they kept wanting me to go to AA meetings, and I just didn't want to go. It took me a while. I didn't want to go. I didn't want to be in them. And in that point, when I kind of was starting to recognize that, you know, alcohol isn't working for me, that it is for other people. It used to make me really upset when I would see, you know, all my friends on social media going out, having a great night. And I would be over here like, why can't I have a good night? Why can't I just go out and dance and have fun with friends? Like, why do I always have to fight with people? I don't want to argue. Why do I always want to argue? And I actually started in Al-Anon, which is, if anybody doesn't know, it's, you know, you're going into meetings that you have a family member or a friend that is not. Like, I started in Al-Anon, and it just didn't jive for me. I was more uncomfortable than anything. And I actually was, God bless his soul. Everybody goes through breakups, but my ex-boyfriend got me into an AA meeting, and I'll forever be grateful for that, because I remember sitting in that first meeting going, why the hell am I resonating with all these people? I remember sitting in that room being like, how are they so happy? You're coming in here knowing you have an issue, and y'all are just smiling and talking about hardships and trauma. And I'm over here sitting in the corner like, this is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Uncomfortable. But that was when it kind of clicked. I went to a couple of meetings and was like, I'm actually resonating with these people and their stories. And some of us in AA kind of joke around about, like, sometimes you'll walk in a meeting and be like, were these people talking about me before I got here? Because why are you telling my story? It's like, why are you saying stuff that I did? You did that too?
Before we get into AA's process, I want to just go back for a moment, ask you a couple of questions that kind of came to me while you were telling that personal story. First off, I'm not even sure about this. Is alcoholism, is it hereditary?
I wouldn't necessarily say yes to that. As the therapist, scientific person that I am, as well as my experience, just for me and my story, yes, my sister and I have those tendencies, but my brother doesn't.
Interesting. I don't know if there is good science on that or not. I was very curious. Is it, or is it just the curse of the Irish?
I'm going to go with that.
I think it's a curse, like, maybe not science.
But I think even as, you know, personally in my experience, that if you even have that, you know, if you're a child of an alcoholic, you're just closer. It's not that you're necessarily going to be there in that realm. I think you're a little bit closer than normies.
Yeah.
just a little bit.
And also, you know, taking this nature nurture approach to things, like, do you think, you know, for those listeners who don't know, you grew up in Kentucky, the bourbon capital of the world, right? Then you move to Tennessee, huge party. It's whiskey, you know, and Nashville, if anyone's been there, this town is built on country music and drinking. Does this affect you? Is this part of it? Do you think this fed to some of this, that party lifestyle?
I can't deny that, because of when you are learning patterns, regardless of what age, whether you're older trying to break old patterns or you're younger building up those patterns. I used to hate what my dad would say, but you do associate with who you're around. Right. When you are around in those environments and atmospheres, especially when I was in college at UK, I didn't want to party when I was in college. I started partying when I was earlier. I was younger going to parties. But when you're around it and your social media is flooded with people going out and all your friends are talking about going out, it's hard. It's very difficult not to feel A, excluded if you're not doing these things. But B, for a long time, I asked those questions to myself of, is there anything else to do but drink?
Right.
All activities are around drinking. All events revolve around alcohol. And when you're in those environments at a constant base, it's hard not to look at it.
Yeah. It's funny because I've lived in both LA and in New York, and those bars are calling last call at 1:30 in the morning. And I was like, I remember how weird it was for me to like, really? The night's just getting started in Louisville because the bars are open.
Whoa, we don't close till 4.
I know. And it's just like, wow. It's like, you know, there really is something that just pushes the alcohol, like 2 more hours of drinking, you know, and it's very odd. So I don't know if that feeds the problem. Because you're right, you know, you are the company you keep. Your dad is right when he says that. I say that all the time. You're the company you keep. You hang around with a bunch of people that play video games and smoke weed, you're probably going to start playing video games and smoke weed. You hang out with criminals, you're going to become a criminal. You know, like,
you're
that's sort of how it is.
In those environments. I mean, when your environment, that's where it's, you know, I love the ABA portion that I also get to bring in, is that I get to recognize stuff like that. I'm very big on, even with my clients, of, okay, what's the environment look like? When you're surrounded in those places, it's hard not to ask those questions. What else am I supposed to do? Nobody else is talking about any other activities. How am I supposed to come up with other activities? Or then if I do, they don't want to do it because it doesn't have to do with alcohol.
Right.
And
right.
Even
yeah.
for me, when, you know, when I sat for a couple of years, even debating with alcohol, that's where, you know, my addictive portion came in. I just replaced it. Okay, well, alcohol is making me fight people. Weed's not going to do that. Hungry, happy, sleepy. What's the problem? But the biggest, and I still kind of, I think any alcoholic, we have an alcoholic brain if I want to fix, manage, and control. And even now, you know, my perspective has changed. And the biggest thing that we say is, you know, it's, you're wanting to escape your own reality. And I did not recognize that for a long time, that, you know, I thought I was doing fine, not drinking anymore and just smoking, but I wasn't recognizing that. Why was I going to smoke? Because I genuinely didn't like myself. I genuinely wanted to escape my own mind, and I can't do it in any other realm. So that's where my journey kind of went in this teetering of, you know, I played with alcohol. I tried to control it, tried to do that, recognized I couldn't. So then I just replaced it with something else. And that's where it hits that issues of, you know, okay, there's those addictive tendencies. Everybody has addictive tendencies, but it's when you're sticking with it. You're actually, okay, well, I'm not doing alcohol anymore. I'm not drinking anymore. I've got no liquor in the house, but I still want to get out of my head. What else can I do? And that's where it's like, because I think there is a lot of, especially right now, you know, like I say this, I'm not going against anybody who smokes. I know that there are so many benefits of some good old Mary Jane, but it's when you start to recognize of, why am I doing it? Asking yourself, why do I feel like I want it or feel like I need it? Because I, you know, to me, my personally, I don't think marijuana is addictive. I was addictive to the escape. I was addicted to the mind altering and getting myself out, because I was happier when I smoked. I actually slept well. I actually ate. I was not fighting anybody, but I couldn't put it down for 5 years.
Yeah.
I couldn't go somewhere without having to smoke first. And then if I went somewhere and it wore off, I'd be looking at the clock like, all right, how much longer do I have to stay? Cause I'm gonna go home and smoke and then I can come back. That's when it's a little bit of, okay, where are you going with this? Cause I mean, that's also, I feel like a very hard conversation in this day and age for us to have, mainly because, you know, there's nothing I'm not personally going against anybody else, but it is, you don't think it's addictive, but the tendencies, you can build those patterns and not recognize it. That was right. What I did. I thought I was perfectly fine. Then I come out sober and I've had friends that are like, oh yeah, man, you were a massive stoner. And I was like, man, did everybody know me?
I didn't know.
Did everybody? I thought I hit it well. I isolated very well.
You did. You had me fooled for sure. I want you to, if you don't mind, if you want to speak about it, I want the listeners to hear, maybe walk us through, what was a typical night like for you at your worst? You know, were you a blackout drunk? Did you, you know, what, like, were you pounding shots? Like, walk me through how an ordinary evening was, if you can share that.
So for me, a lot of it was an ordinary in the chaos and mayhem. For me, when I was drinking, was the worst that I had gotten. I would actually have spent, let's say it was a Friday or Saturday. Say we went out on a Friday or Saturday. I had a rough night that night. It's the next day. It's the next day that I'm, you know, I did blackout. But, you know, even sometimes when you blackout, you have some sort of the pictures and memories and a little bit of the evening kind of piecing itself together.
Sure.
I woke up the next day after years of doing this and being like, I can't do that anymore. I don't want to do that anymore. I'm ruining relationships with people. I'm humiliating myself out. But I should have a drink right now. What? Like, I mean, even the next day after causing mayhem, being stupid, hungover, I'm still sitting there looking at alcohol and asking my, like, having that debate, that ping pong in my head of, well, I could just have a seltzer right now because I got to get rid of the hangover, right? Hair of the dog. Or if it was something like, a lot of it really especially is, and a lot of us as alcoholics say this too, there isn't just one. It isn't just one.
Right.
I tried desperately to go out and be like, all right, I'm just going to have one drink tonight. But after that one, I'm stuck. We call it in the book an allergy, and it genuinely is, because I remember even being out somewhere, having the conversation with the man that I was dating at that time, saying, I need to slow down and I need to quit. And even he's like, okay, we'll just have one drink tonight. Nope, there is no one. I couldn't stop at one. Because when I had that one, you get that little buzz and you're like, oh, well, I can keep going because I don't want the buzz to go away.
Right.
So maybe if I have a water first, then have another drink. You just come up with these different excuses to keep going and keep trying. Sometimes it was, you know, for a little bit when I was younger, I did try the whole, okay, I'm only going to take a couple shots and then just have water or soda. That didn't work because, again, there is no one. There's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
Or even when, you know, in my roughest times in college and I was desperately trying to control it, I used to even go to the bars and just ask for soda and would end up coming back for a drink. Mainly because the bartender is mad at me. Like, oh, you're really just going to get a soda. Right. I'm over here like, bro, I just tipped you $20 for a Dr. Pepper. Why are you getting mad at me?
Yeah.
But even in that, and that's the biggest thing that even most of us alcoholics say that in our various stories of that, I always want more. One is not enough. I always want more. And that even fed into my smoking. For a while when I started, it was, you know, okay, just after work. I could do it just after work. Then it turned into after work and in the morning. And then it turned into after work in the morning and on my breaks. And that's where it's like, it's always, I want one more. I can't set it down. I just want one more. And until I got into this program, I mean, I didn't even notice that. I just kept asking myself, why am I having this ping pong? I mean, yeah. I had a rough family vacation. I am a flight risk. When I get intoxicated, I will fight with you and take off. I don't know where I'm going, but I'll take off. I will just go. And even in that, having that rough night, I was walking barefoot for like 5+ miles. The next day I was staring at alcohol like, okay, today I could have one more. That's what it's like in the aspect of it. That's what it's like of that allergy that we talk about or that desire we talk about.
Sure.
One's never enough. I just want more because all in all, what am I doing in all of this? Trying to escape myself.
Right. Let's get into, you mentioned Al-Anon. Tell me how the AA experience was different. What made you accept that, gravitate toward that as a process?
Personally, for me, it was more of, I was resonating with the stories. I mean, I still resonated with stories in Al-Anon, but the stories in AA were personal. It was a personal connection. I felt like I was unique and different. And I actually figured out I'm not different. And the other part of me is that I had tried, you know, I also plan to go back to Al-Anon when I finish my step work. I'm only halfway through right now, but I do plan on, we call it double dipping. I plan to do AA and Al-Anon because I do have an alcoholic in my family. But for me in this point and where I'm at in my journey, I needed more solutions. I felt like Al-Anon was more of us talking about these things. What did you try? What did I try? There wasn't really other solutions. And I needed those personal deep connections towards myself for a solution. And a lot of it is what we say is that awakening. I needed that to recognize what I needed to do differently. Al-Anon still gives you great supports and great solutions. But I think where I was at mentally, it's just not what I needed. I needed those, okay, I'm still trying to go do this. I'm still trying to go do this. And Al-Anon is all about somebody else doing those things and how we can respond. How do we respond as the friend or the family member when they're continuously trying to control their drinking?
Sure.
I needed, what am I supposed to do when I'm sitting this Tasmanian devil going back and forth of, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. And I was tired. I was so exhausted with fighting myself and hating myself and being so angry. And that's what AA gave me. AA gave me those personal deep connections and gave me the step work to work through it. Al-Anon doesn't give you the work through your personal life.
Sure. And let's dig into this for a second. Many people will call AA a 12-step program. A lot of people hear that 12-step program, go to a 12-step program. Explain the steps, the process of the steps, what they're about.
I actually even pulled up, because I like to, anybody can go look them up online. Anybody can go look up those 12 steps, but I like when it's broken down in a different way and more simplicity type. So step one is recognizing you're powerless and unmanageable. That's step one, is recognizing that I need to accept that I have a problem. That's it. Step two is only a power greater than ourselves can help overcome our alcoholism or addiction and restore me back to sanity. Step two, honestly, I couldn't stand it when I walked in. I went from a Christian to atheist. I was angry at God. And AA has no judgment. Your step two is your step two. Whether you believe in that mountain as your higher power or that tree or this cup, it doesn't matter. It's who you pray to, who you have faith in.
Sure.
And what works for you. That's it. That's why we say a lot of your higher power. A lot of it will also say God, but not going to lie to you, me included, a lot of us kind of steer away from that. Of, if you come at me like God, Bible, this, I did that. A lot of us did. A lot of us tried to. But AA gives you more of personal. It's your awakening. It's your spiritual journey. Step three and step two kind of go together. Two is recognizing your higher power. And three is your personal decision to rely on that higher power. It's your actual actions into that belief. Step two is just recognizing it.
Yeah.
Step four, I'm going to be brutally honest with y'all. Step four is horrible. It's great. It's absolutely beautiful, but it's horrible. It is taking a personal inventory of yourself. So essentially, character defects. What have I done wrong? Who have I done wrong? And what the hell did I do? It's you recognizing you take a three-step inventory of resentments, who you've held on to, what you've held on to. A lot for me was my trauma and personal people who did that trauma to me. You have your fears. And then the good old sex inventory of people that you screwed over and looking at all of your patterns. At step four, step five is not only admitting to ourselves those personal defects, admitting it to your higher power and to your other person, to one other person, that is your sponsor. Essentially, you know, step four, you write everything out. And then step five is speaking it, is literally reading off everything that you have done in the mayhem to your sponsor. Step six is our defects of character have led to where we are now. This is actually where I'm at right now. It's basically doing our prayers of I've recognized the good and the bad within me, and I'm handing it off. I'm handing it off to my higher power. I know this is who I am. I know this is what I have done. I accept that, and I'm letting go. I got to finally let go of all this. Step seven is we become willing to our higher power to remove all those defects. So six and seven usually go hand in hand as well. Step eight and nine also kind of go hand in hand. Step eight is our addiction and alcoholism has led us to harm ourselves and others. And then step nine is making those amends to those people. So you're kind of six, seven, and eight are kind of building up to step nine for you to make amends. You're recognizing your defects. You're letting it go. I'm recognizing I've hurt other people. And now, you know what? I got to own up to it. I got to own up to what I've done. And then 10, 11, and 12, we call it kind of like the maintenance. 10 is actions that are needed to maintain our recovery. A lot of 10 and 4 kind of go hand in hand because then you start doing a daily inventory. Did I hurt anybody today? Did I do anything today? What should I do better? 11 is your prayer and meditation. Whatever works for you to live accordingly in your higher powers journey, you know, how else I'm going to do it. It's a lot of what we talk about, that just meditation. It's I actually heard somebody in a meeting the other day say it so perfectly. Step 11 is like, you know, you've been going to war this whole time. Set your sword down and await instruction, which is the hardest part. Which is the hardest part. But it's, you know, it's set your weapons down and await instruction. Don't act out like you would. My feelings are impacted. I'm not going to jump out and act out. I'm going to sit. I'm going to sit and wait. I have a new perspective. I have new tools. This is how I'm going to respond now. And 12 is essentially carrying out that message to others that are suffering, because the whole point of us going through these 12 steps is helping the next alcoholic, helping the next person. And that's your 12th step is look, this is who I am now. I hope I can help you. And that's kind of where you go out and find sponsees and, you know, you keep the ball rolling with it. You help the next person.
Right. Wow. You know, I want to go back to, I'll say, you know, with my Metatomics books, I've got two Metatomics books out now, a third one coming out this year. And, congrats. You know, the core of Advanced Metatomics is physical, mental, spiritual, That's really what it is. If you're lacking in one of those things, you may not really be a fully functioning human being. So that's a huge emphasis in what I write about.
That's a lot about what we say as well, mind, body, and spirit. I mean, it all kind of goes hand in hand. The one beautiful thing that even someone being that was, you know, pretty religious to jumping off the handle and then finding this is personal. It's individualized. Your spiritual journey is your spiritual journey. I can't tell you what your God is. I can't tell you how to pray. I can't tell you how to listen to what your higher power is telling you. You can find it out. I can sit here and hold your hand and help you, but I can't answer those questions.
Yeah. And I think people aren't operating the way they really can if they're in, you know, positive control of the mind and negative control of the body or any number of combinations and where you're at with your physiological attunement, which is what the first Advanced Metatomics book is called, Physiological Attunement. And it's about your physical proficiency, your mental proficiency, your spiritual proficiency. And it runs through steps on how you can maintain that or work on it or improve on it. But I want to go back to just the physical aspect of this. The first days when you quit drinking, I want you to tell people about that struggle. Was it easy? Was it difficult? Did you go 4 days without drinking and then you drank? I mean, was this, because by the time this podcast comes out, we're hoping you're going to be at 9 months.
Right.
Right now you have, as we're recording this, you have a 6 month point. So, but I want to know about the first days. What was that like? How often did you stumble and fall backwards before you got some consistency? What can people look forward to? I don't know if that's the word I want to use. What can they expect from their journey to get off liquor?
Personally, for me, I've heard multitude of stories. You know, if you're further, you know, I had been trying desperately for so long to set alcohol down, but some people come in, you know, having more physiological, you know, responses. You know, sometimes some people get shakes with it. Sometimes some people get, you know, different aspects like that. For me personally, it was the first week. The whole week was rough because life is still going to life. Things are still going to happen. You're still going to get hit with those same triggers that you got before that brought you to that drink. And it was a lot of a mental battle with it of, do I want this? And that's the biggest thing that I will tell anybody that's contemplating this is, if you actually want it, you will do it. There's nothing that's going to stop you from that, but you have to want it because it's not easy. Even as the journey has gone, yes, it's gotten easier, but that doesn't make it easy. I still have moments where I'm like, damn, a bourbon sounds good. Or, man, I'm so tired of work right now. I really want that scotch because I know it's just going to calm down and ease this. And I mean, those aspects may never go away. It is very rough, but it is a personal desire that you want to do. And this is where you do a lot of trial and error of, what am I going to do instead? My first week was essentially me trial and erroring with my own solutions. Okay, my feelings are impacted. I want to go get high. I want to drink. Can't do that. What am I going to do instead? Well, I'll go try this. For me, I've always known that me and my little hippie self, I like to be outside. There's something about, for me, that earth. It's just hiking, even since I was in Nashville, has become my own meditation. This is where you find those ways of, how can I make these healthy habits break my not so great habits? And it's hard. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. It is very, very difficult and frustrating because sometimes hiking works and sometimes it doesn't. But I have more of the desire to not turn around. I am so unbelievably stubborn. It's unreal. I'm not starting over. And that was what really drove me to keep going, was that, sure, I'm 7 days, 9 days in and work went crazy this week. I could go get a drink. Nobody would know. Nobody's in my house. nobody sees me in here at 2 o'clock in the morning after a rough day at work. I could easily just drink a little bottle, but I would know. I would give a piece away of my sobriety out, and I'm not willing to do that. So you know what? What am I going to do different? I'm going to try and go outside. I know that works. The tanning bed. I know the sun, you know, I got to get the fake light bulbs because the sun's not out. I'm going to go work out. I may have already worked out today, but if I just go into the gym, and a lot of it truly really is go to meetings. That's what they're there for. And talk. That was the biggest struggle that I had, was speaking out on those burning desires and speaking in a meeting. Because when you're having those rough days that first week, you've got to have that support group that's going to talk you through it, that's been through it. That's what got me through my first month was I may have already gone to 2 meetings this week, but I'm having a rough night. I'm pulling up my Zoom. I know there's a meeting somewhere, or I know there's a person that's going to answer this phone call. That's a part of those trial and errors. And when you speak out, you may be not only helping the next person who doesn't want to speak out, but multiple people are going to come up to you after that meeting and talk you through it and answer those phone calls. I mean, that's why we say you've got to get a sponsor, because I'm not going to lie to you. That first week I was calling her almost daily.
Yeah.
Daily of what else am I supposed to do? I tried going hiking. I tried to go to the gym and I'm still over here. I want to go get a bottle. What am I supposed to do? Talk it out. Talk it out with another alcoholic, because not only do they understand in the depths of their core what you're feeling, they may have another solution that you never even thought of.
Right.
I mean, I still got them right now. Mine was actually my 4 months when I started my fourth step, looking at those resentments and looking at, I basically had a trauma list sitting in front of me, and I'm suicidal. If I don't go towards alcohol or getting high, I go straight to suicide. There is no in between. And I still now have an entire list of phone numbers, an entire list of people from in a meeting when I spoke out about it, who notes of when I can call. That's what gets you through it. Your support group is what gets you through it.
Yeah.
Because there's other people out there who felt it, but when you don't, I mean, I know a lot of people now, even too, did the same thing I did. When you don't speak out on it, you're drowning yourself. Why? There's hands out here that are willing to help pull you out. Reach out. Even if it's just saying, the biggest thing for me was just saying, I'm not okay. I was taught my whole life to put that mask on and put that face on and smile when you walk out. No, honesty and willingness. I am not okay. Help. And that was it. That in itself is what gets you through it.
Yeah. I'm doing the quick math here, and I'm thinking back, if you're 6 months sober now, I'm thinking you had to have been sober during Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas. That sounds incredibly difficult. What was that like for you?
And in those first 3 months? I went through, my favorite holiday is Halloween. Halloween I had begun to surround myself with other alcoholics. I mean, that was the first thing that I needed, was finding other people who not only felt the same way as me, but knowing I wasn't alone. That's what really got me through a lot of those holidays. And I honestly not only went through all the holidays, but I went through a breakup all sober within 3 months.
Wow. Was the breakup a result of the alcoholism, or just falling, going different ways?
It was sobriety. We were both in sobriety. So, I mean, and honestly, you know, I'm not going to lie and not sit here and say I wasn't heartbroken and I didn't hurt from it, but because of it happening, I was able to get through my step 3. I was able to actually be like, I legitimately cannot control anything that's happening. Somebody, whatever it is upstairs, you know what? I'm giving an out. I could have easily gone to, I could have easily gone to get high. I had multiple people I could have called. multiple people who knew that I was going through a breakup and knew that I had just gone through Christmas. But it was, I was desperate to look at the positive. I was very, I surrounded myself with people, and I'm not going to lie to you, I went to probably a meeting straight for a week. I went to a meeting every day for a week and spoke about it and was honest. I mean, I felt so pathetic. It was such a short relationship, and we ended on great terms, and, you know, our relationship was honestly great terms, but we both knew we were in early sobriety and we had some personal things that we had to get through. Sure. But I surrounded myself with the right people, just like we were talking earlier about your environment. I mean, that's what got me through it. I mean, the family get-togethers at Thanksgiving and Christmas, it was hard seeing everybody drink. But that's my positive out of it. That figured out what my sober drink is. I feel like everybody has their specific sober drink. My Shirley Temples. I get a little bit of, the main thing I wanted was a burn. I recognize, okay, out of alcohol, what did I want? I wanted that burn. I wanted to feel it. How can I replace that in a healthy way? Soda. Okay.
Right.
LaCroix. I used to hate LaCroix. Now I got a whole sparkling water because I want the burn. But it's as simple as that. And I mean, I used to have to, especially through that breakup, I mean, I was calling people at midnight and 1 a.m. being like, I feel so pathetic and stupid. Why do I care? It was a good breakup. I just went through holidays and I made it through holidays easily. I mean, mind you, I made it through holidays with another person that was sober. So anytime we had issues, we could look at each other and leave. And sometimes right. That's what it is. I mean, sometimes I have to do it now. If I see my mom pull out that bottle, I know. I'm like, boundary, gotta go. And it's simple things like that. So if there's anybody who is having a hard time, especially with those holidays, first off, look at it one day at a time. We are not there yet. That bridge will be there when we're there. One day at a time. And when you're at those events, find a person, find something, whether that's a person that's with you or somebody you can call, and set those boundaries for yourself. You have your personal goals. And if sobriety is your desire and personal goal, you will make it. But don't think you can do it alone. You don't have to.
Yeah.
Call somebody, yeah. Set those boundaries and get out of there if you have to, and go to a meeting. Because I mean, that's what personally works for me.
Someone told me once that early in their sobriety journey, one of the things that AA frowned upon was going into new relationships. Is that true? And why is that?
So from what I understand of it, especially when you're in early sobriety, you are working on yourself. Your first year is supposed to be about yourself. Tell me how you can be selfish and about yourself when you're in a relationship.
True. Yeah.
You can't.
Makes sense.
And that's honestly the hard pill I had to swallow when we went through our breakup. Is I sat there one day and was like, I was blocking myself from a lot that I could have been working on early on because I was focused elsewhere.
Yeah.
When you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you're not thinking about yourself. You're thinking about them. And that's not a bad thing. You know what I mean? Like I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but that's why they kind of, they frown upon it. Like we got in a relationship and we were fine. You know what I mean? Like people get in relationships in early recovery all the time, but it's asking yourself and having those, if you can't have those difficult conversations with your partner, you're blocking yourself from your own healing without recognizing it.
Yeah.
I didn't even recognize I was doing that for my first 3 months sober. I didn't recognize being in the relationship with him. I was blocking myself from healing that I desperately needed to do. And the only way that happened to me was the breakthrough through the breakup. I wasn't fighting my higher power anymore because I genuinely couldn't do it anymore. But I also didn't even recognize I don't know how I would have gone through resentments being in a relationship, to be fully honest with you, because I would have been more ashamed of somebody else seeing what's on this paper. I didn't talk to him about my sexual assault in my past. I don't want to talk to you about that. We're dating. You're going to look at me different.
Yeah.
That in itself right there. It's you don't realize that you're doing these things when you're in a relationship. And your first year of sobriety is about your healing.
Yeah.
It's about you. And, you know, even now I even have the hard times of I've had people come out of the woodwork here lately of being like, man, you're so different now. We should go do this. We should be on a date. And I've even had to set those boundaries of, look, I'm working on myself. I know when I'm in a relationship, I put my all in. And right now I have to stop myself from, I mean, I'll be blunt with you. We all make booty calls. Like, I have to stop myself from that. I have to don't send that text message. Don't call this person. Don't let this person come over. Because right now I have to recognize, why do I want the validation from another person? What is the void within me that I need this comfort? You're not going to do that if you're with somebody else.
Yeah. And you mentioned, and this makes me think of two things I want to bring up. One, I can't help but wonder if some sexual gratification from a booty call would be a trigger, maybe activate the reward center of the brain and then pull you in. You know, I don't know if that's true or if there's science behind that, but it makes sense to me that that could happen.
Absolutely. For me, just because I finished, I just finished my inventory, my sex inventory. And I recognized a lot of the patterns of the chaos that I was doing, that when, you know, one guy over here gives me that rejection or, you know, hurts my pride a little bit, I want to feed it over here with these five different guys that are thinking that I'm a goddess walking around.
Yeah.
That's causing harm. Yeah. That's causing harm. I don't genuinely want a relationship with any of these five guys. I just want you to boost my ego.
Sure.
Not fair to anybody.
I remember I guest on Drew Pinsky's podcast a lot, Dr. Drew, and I've known him for many, many years. And I remember him telling me one time about, you know, his feelings, because, you know, he's been in addiction recovery for a very, very long time. And I remember asking him one time about, you know, when people get off drugs or alcohol and they're like chain smoking constantly or eating. And he's like, you know what? They're trading one vice for another. I'd rather them eat a bunch of pie every day than do heroin. You know, he's like, there's acceptable things that we want, but you know, everyone's kind of find that
still addictive tendencies, still addictive tendencies. Yeah. And sex is very, very powerful. It is very powerful. Intimacy is powerful. And it could very well trigger anything.
Mm-hmm.
It could trigger you back into the madness. It may not. It could. But actually, my sister and I were joking about that the other day, was that, you know, I just traded my vice. Now I want sweets. Mm-hmm. Now I want sweets. And now I want this. And that's alcoholism. More.
For sure. And, you know, another thing that occurred to me was when you were mentioning, we were talking about whether relationships would be healthy, you know, in that first year. I was started to wonder about the person who was alone. Like, you have a big family, you have nieces and nephews, and like, you have a very large family.
Blessed.
So you have people around at a friend's base and college people.
Too. I mean, I have family members who call me randomly and are just like, you know what? I just want to say, it's amazing what you're doing. I mean, and not everybody has that, but that's why you build your support group, because you don't have to have family members that do it. But when you have a home group and you have other alcoholics that are with
you, that's who you can go to. So you're not alone in your apartment as a drunk with no one and no relationship. You can go to those people. So AA is a support group in that way.
And by definition. Personally believe, and I'm sure some people have done it, and you know, I'm sorry for anybody if I'm attacking, but I do not believe you can do this alone. I do not believe it at all. There is no way you could go through these steps, and you could be dry drunk. You could be sober alone. Absolutely. But you're not working on trauma. You're not talking it out with another person. You're not reaching out. You know what I mean? Like, there's a whole different type of awakening you get when you get that support from other people. And not only that, you get this, the fact that I am not the only, try not to massively cuss, the fact that I am not the only completely messed up individual and you have had these thoughts too, that is so amazingly powerful, knowing I am not the only one. And that's exactly what AA brings. That's what recovery brings you, is other people who understand the demons that sit on your shoulder daily that try to talk to you. They yeah. understand it on a whole different level that I don't even have to explain it. All I have to say is, I'm not okay. And they're like, okay. Or I'm like, you know what? I'm about to go buy a gun and blow myself up, like blow my head off. And they're like, I've been there. I felt like, let's talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to bring up something else. You know, this has been a great interview and we're getting close to the end here, but there was one thing that came up that I really wanted to address to see if it was triggering for you. You were in Louisville, Kentucky. And at the time of the recording of this interview, a few weeks ago, there was a mass shooting.
Yep.
When something like that, something tragic happens in your community, is that a trigger for things? So let's talk about that for a moment. And maybe not necessarily for you, but for other people.
Ironically, that you even bring that up, I had a family member that was involved. So no, it would have been, this is the beauty of AA, y'all. Like, it would have been triggering for me. It was the third traumatic thing that was hitting me at that time. I had two other things that were going on, and then that mass shooting happened, and I happened to have a family member who was in that room that got shot at. I will say, in whether it's a mass shooting or whatever is going on, it is absolutely triggering. But that's why we have this step work, and that's why we have the support that we have. I was able to call my sponsor that day, that morning, when I walked out of a day program and my family was blowing up my phone. And I had friends reaching out asking if my family member was okay and if I'm okay. And my trauma response has always been to shut down. But I was actually able to be in that moment and say it. I've never been able to do that in my life. I actually walked out of that day program with people on the phone with me asking if I was okay. And I said, no, I've completely shut down. I mean, even at the hospital all day that day, I mean, my whole family is crying. Nothing. I had nothing. I couldn't cry. I shut down. Mm. That is my trauma response. I was just standing there feeling horrible, but I knew that, okay, I've seen a lot of death. A lot of death has happened in my family and in my friends. I know how I respond. The main thing I've got to look at right now is I got to take this 1 minute at a time. I'm sober right now. I'm sober right now. I'm sober right now. I'm going to stay sober, but I'm sober right now. What can I do right now? It is absolutely triggering, but sometimes that's where you've got to go to that toolbox. For me, it's taking it 1 minute at a time. Okay. 1 minute, I'm looking at the clock. 1 minute, I'm sober. Okay. What can I do right now? What can I do to distract myself? And honestly, we have separate prayers that we do per step. And I haven't even gotten to this step of it, but the acceptance prayer. I mean, you know, whoever is listening and is resonating with this prayer, it's a phrase. It's something that somebody told you. Sometimes you got to repeat it a million times. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I repeated that acceptance prayer. Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. Nothing happens in God's world by mistake. Over and over and over and over and over again. And just when I couldn't say it again, look over, clock, I made it 10 more minutes. That's all that matters. I just got to make it 10 more minutes. Yeah. And I mean, whoever resonates with that, that is all trauma, whether you're an alcoholic addict or not. It's how you recognizing how you respond and still reminding yourself of, I've been through this before, or I've done this before. I've got to do something different right now. What's going to work for me right now? Personally, for me, it was saying the same prayer over and over again. And almost doing grounding work of recognizing where I was at. Yes, we were sitting in a hospital for an entire day, not knowing what was going to happen. But he's alive right now. That's all I could hold on to. If that's what I'm going to hold on to, that's what I'm going to hold on to. He's alive. He's alive right now. We're together right now. The shooting is over right now. Whatever it is, it's usually when it hits those points that you are triggered, you got to go back to square one, whatever that is for you. And usually it's quite simple and it's just repetitive.
I'm glad that, you know, your relative is alive and doing well. Related question to the shooting, just, you know, I know we're kind of veering off just a tiny bit from your personal story here, but the shooter, do you have anger toward the shooter when it started to come out that he had mental issues?
Oh, absolutely.
Where are you at in your professional career in terms of how you feel about this person?
The main thing that really, really angered me about it was that he was in personal connection with my family member. And then when it came out about everything, not only was it a premeditated situation that he thought, the shooter thought that he was going to be part of the solution and trying to say how easy it is for someone with mental illness to be able to do all this. First off, we already knew that. Second off, don't you put that title of depression and suicidal ideation on all of us. Because all of us who are like me that also have those tendencies, I would never in my life hurt another person. I kind of go the opposite way. I would hurt myself. Yes, I will give you that. But to me, that is a whole other identity of a mental illness. There is something else in your brain that makes you want to hurt somebody else. It's just like when we talk about with serial killers. They have signs when they're younger of killing animals. Not once in my entire life of mayhem, of manic episodes, have I ever, ever wanted to hurt another human being. That to me is another identity in itself. That is something else in your brain that is different. Don't you put depression and suicidal ideation on that, because that's not what it is. Because now you're just stigmatizing the rest of us that are trying desperately to break a stigma we've already got. And suicidal ideation, let's look the definition up of that. That is harming yourself, not another person. Not another person. That was the main thing that really got me, was y'all are putting the incorrect title on that. You're going to do whatever you want anyway. I can't control that. But you're not about to stigmatize me for that.
Yeah.
Not about to stigmatize the rest of these boys and girls that I see desperately trying to keep themselves alive every day because you wanted to make a different standpoint. That's something different entirely.
Now, let me ask you this also, you know, just from a professional opinion, and I'm in no way endorsing supporting what the shooter did. There is some science coming around now about concussions and triggering incredibly violent activity from people. Do you think there's any credibility to that? Or do you think him putting his manifesto out there was, you know, aligning him in a different way? What do you think about that?
I would honestly like to look more of the science on concussions, because your brain is just so powerful. I mean, it is unbelievable muscle. It's an unbelievable piece of meat we sit there and hold there. I mean, it is, I can't deny thinking that if you had a blow of some sort to your head, that it would shift things. I don't even know if a doctor would be able to answer that either.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt in my mind that you could hit yourself hard enough and you become a different person. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind about that, because of how powerful your brain is in controlling your emotions.
There's a lot of athletes that have had their brains donated now. And I think one of the most famous stories was the wrestler Chris Benoit, who executed his little kid. Like, it takes a lot for someone to murder a little child. Absolutely. Those are the worst, most evil types of murderers right there. And even the school shootings are going into kindergartens. Like, it's just, it's maddening. Like, it, I just don't understand how
even how, you know, much they've been able to notice of what is different in their brain? Is it neurotransmitters that are going differently? Is it coming from a different direction? Like, what's actually happening? Because, you know, I hate to even say this, though, but if a brain is dead, it's not working. How are you supposed to recognize the pathways of any decision making when it's no longer intact? So how much information can we actually get from that? But it's beautiful what science can find out anyway.
And none of this is an excuse for that tragic event, for sure. And you know, how personally a degree away you are affected to this is terrible and awful. And I'm glad you made it through that yourself, you know, not to mention your relative that's survived too.
He has been unbelievable in this recovery that he has gone through. I mean, I have to put that out there. I mean, he has been the response. I mean, the trauma that he went through being in that room in itself and being able to walk out while five other people didn't walk out that he knew personally in a person, like outside of work, that in itself is unfathomable. I mean, I can't even imagine, but it's even like, it's almost like the shooter had one of those heroistic concepts. Like he wanted gun laws or whatever, like whatever.
What your relative went through, you know, I said this earlier in the show, you know, physical, mental, spiritual, it's a complete collapse of all of those things at once, because you take a physical trauma if you're shot. You witness a massacre, which will be a mental scar forever. And the spiritual dilemma of how could a person be so evil to do this? You lose a lot of faith in things, you know.
Yeah.
It's a complete collapse on all those.
I mean, all of it, like it just, and not only on top of all of that is that hit national news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's almost like a lifetime of people asking questions about it. I mean, that in itself to me is hard to even grasp myself, that Louisville was on the news for like a week.
Until the next mass shooting, and then it wasn't on the news anymore when the next mass shooting happened, you know?
Yeah. And then, you know, it's something else. And it's like, how do you not see that you're adding, like, as the shooter was, how do you not see that that's adding to the pattern? You literally just gave somebody else a blueprint. Are you serious?
Mm-hmm. Kentucky is a really difficult, you know, I grew up in Indiana. There's, you know, that wall, you know, we're Indiana people.
That's that wall right there between Indiana and Kentucky.
I actually have a lot of problems with Kentucky, and I hate to knock the state, but, you know, it's one of the lowest in education, just above Mississippi, you know? And it's a state filled with everything about guns and liquor and cigarettes. All the worst stuff seems to evolve.
And then when you put them together,
and it's just this worst kind of combustion. And I've never really had a lot of respect for the state because of just sort of what they've stood for all this time. And it's a very, you know, there are great people in the state for sure. I'm a UK basketball fan. Like I can't knock the state in a lot of ways, but you know, there are very parts of it fundamentally. Fundamentally, there's a lot of issues there. Yeah. You know, and also, you know,
you go outside of Louisville and it's country town.
And this is I tell people before. I tell my friends this in New York and LA when they can't understand why the Democrats don't run everything. Because I said, you really need to travel across the country and see what the country's really like. Because like even in Georgia, sure, Atlanta, it's the largest city in the South. A lot of people don't realize that.
Go outside of Atlanta, though.
But go outside of Atlanta. Yeah, go outside of Atlanta and see what the rest of it's like.
Go
and
outside then you of really Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
For go sure. outside of even, I mean, we don't even have to stay in the South. Go outside of Chicago, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
It's all cornfields. It's all farms. Yeah.
It's all farms and it's different.
All
and
it's rural. I mean, and you can't deny that type of population either, but that type of population is also still kind of stuck in traditional ways.
They're stuck so far in the past. Mm-hmm.
We have already advanced in other different cities and it's like, we almost need to compromise. Like it's not a one way or the other way. We need both to be able to compromise to actually be able to get anything done.
Yeah. you go, you know, I don't know if you remember my wife or not, but she was Latina. And I remember going out to Litchfield and whatever, I can't remember what county that is in Litchfield, but I remember my friend telling me we were going to go another county over. So we would be three counties out of like Louisville, right? We were going to go see a friend of ours that was a professional wrestle in this small town. And my friend in Litchfield says, yeah, you shouldn't go to that county. And I said, why? And he goes, well, your wife. And I was like, what? And they're like, yeah, you can't take a Latino to that county. Mm. Like, he's just, and I'm like, really?
He's and like, it honestly is just so, it's still surprising to me. And it's heartbreaking to the fact that we have been able to make progress in such realms. And we still have certain places where you can't have your wife. I can't have a friend. I can't walk into a store with one of my best friends that's been in my life for 15 years just mm-hmm. because the color of his skin. And it boils my skin of like, I get that you're in your traditional ways and I hate to come after anybody else for their uniqueness, but are you serious?
Mm-hmm. What? You know, when I was talking about Atlanta, you know, Atlanta, you know, the needle points, it's the majority is Black now. So around 60% of Atlanta proper is Black. So everything else is a minority in Atlanta. A lot of people, when you walk around Atlanta, it doesn't really feel like that, but it is, right? That's where the needle points. But one thing I didn't know about Atlanta is a sanctuary city for Blacks that are gay. And I remember, so I had working in the entertainment community down there, a friend of mine, right. Black and gay. And he said, imagine how hard it is to be Black in the South anyways, much less be Black and gay. And he said, in this city, Atlanta became a city like this, just like San Francisco was for whites that were gay. And I thought, wow, it was like mind blown. Because you don't think of it like that. Like you think, wow, it was already hard enough to be Black in Mississippi, but imagine being Black and gay in Mississippi.
And, you know? And already getting an unbelievable amount of unnecessary hatred, just unnecessary. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's heartbreaking. I'm just, I love to at least hear the positives of it, that there are inclusion. There is still mm-hmm. inclusion. I hate that it's still more of like a line, you know, we have, okay, well, you have to stay on this side of the line, but you can't cross this line. You can't go across into this county. And it's just, you would think that where we are in our day and age, that we would have been able to, I can't even, put the ignorance out, like just take that ignorance. You can't take it out of somebody, but you know what I mean? Like be able to take that out and be like, look, we all thought differently 20 years ago, 50 years ago, but look at where we are now.
Yeah.
Inclusion is a part of that.
Yeah. I encourage anyone, travel around, see the country. You got to see how the world is. And it doesn't matter whether you're a small town, you need to go to a big city.
Culture shocks are almost necessary. Like I would advise anybody, absolutely, get outside of your comfort zone and see somebody else and how they walk in their shoes. And mm-hmm. you will open up your eyes to so many different things.
You'll start to understand. And that's the part, is people need to communicate. They need to understand instead of building these walls up. And that's the problem in the country, and so triggering for so many. And but I mean, I know
we do that with AA. I mean,
yeah,
I've gotten mixed different kind of people saying comments to me of, well, you didn't have a problem. And I'm over here like, how can you tell me I didn't have a problem?
Yeah.
Were you there when I was 14? Oh no. Were you there when I was 20? Huh? No. Were you there when I was 24? No. Yeah. It's just like anybody else. You don't live in their shoes. You don't know their, story. Yeah. You don't know what's impacted them, what trauma, what triggers. And you can't pretend like you do. So how can you stigmatize it when you don't genuinely know?
I certainly never knew you had any problem. Like I've known Caroline, I've known your sister for a long time. And I knew her cycles, what she was capable of, what she did. And she would talk to me about that. And she figured out a way for herself. But I had no idea.
She made the path for me. Yeah. I tried for so long, and God bless her soul, she made that path for us. And even to this day, when I even get backlash, it, you know, even when you get backlash, you've got your support.
I feel so bad now that every time I came to Louisville and I would send you a message that I was in town, I would say, do you want to have a drink somewhere? I feel awful. I've even gotten to the point.
I love it now, to be fully honest. I've been to Tin Roof. I've been to Play. I've been to live shows, and I'm not necessarily like dating right now, but like I've gone on dates and they've been like, are you going to be upset if I have a drink? And I'm over here like, bitch, by four, because you got to make up for me not having any.
Oh, man.
Like
you and Abel, are you?
You better have two beers and I'm going to watch you drink both of them because you got to have one for me. I mean, and don't get me wrong, in the beginning, it was a lot harder. When I first started going to concerts and stuff, it was a lot harder, but man, when you make it through it, it's so much better because then you get to watch all the drunk people do stupid shit and you get to look over and be I would have done that. Look at me now. Look at me now, Shirley Temple.
Wow. Well, Paige, this has been a great interview and a great way to catch up with everyone. And I do hope you come back again and continue this story. Honestly, into some interesting side topics.
I did the most bold thing. I've got my sobriety date. I can turn around now.
Yeah, for sure. Are you out there on the interwebs anywhere? Can people find you out there on social media if they want to ask you a question?
Yeah, Instagram or Facebook. My Facebook does have my first name on it. Kind of throws people for a loop. So if you need to look for me, it is Meredith Page. And I think my Instagram my Instagram is also Meredith Page 14.
Okay.
But absolutely, anybody that's got questions about it, anybody that wants to even stay anonymous that has been having a especially having a hard time with your addiction or your alcoholism or being in starting out in a program, not sure whether going to a program, I always want to say, you know, we don't promote, but I will show you what this life is like. I'm not going to promote, I'm not going to push you towards it, but I will show you that my life is unbelievably amazing now. I hated myself for 29 years and now I'm pretty fucking awesome. I'm pretty fucking cool. I'm one unique breed and I love it.
Well, that's great. Well, that's the way to end the show right there. Paige, thanks for coming out today and we'll talk soon, okay?
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.